The Guardian. And welcome to Guardian Football Weekly. The battle of the Premier League heavyweights did not disappoint, but it was Liverpool landing the knockout punch. Have they literally handed themselves the title? And does anyone actually understand the handball laws anymore? The kids are all right. Leicester's lads and Chelsea's children chased down Jurgen Klopp's side, while City slipped to fourth, and Ashley Barnes is back. There are FA Cup shocks, women's attendances to discuss, and is Phil Neville's job really under threat? All that, we'll round up all the action from Europe, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Okay, attendance check. There's a three-person panel, so four of us in the studio. That's four. The growth of Guardian Football Weekly is stable, you will be pleased to know. And it's a Scandinavian takeover today. Hello, Marcus Christensen.
Good morning.
How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. Good to hear. Hi, Lars Sivertsen.
Herring.
Well,
the Scandinavians are here, I guess. How you doing?
Did you bring in
I did not, because that would have been a wildly unpopular move in the pod, I think, if I broke out the herring.
Marcus has brought in sweets, I see.
They come directly from Sweden via producer Jonathan, who was there over the weekend, it seems.
Yeah. Wonderful, wonderful.
I'll share them around after the pod.
Excellent, I look forward to that. Hi there, Barry Glendenning.
Birdie, 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 birdie.
You're the Swedish chef
from The Muppets. Just trying to fit in.
Right, okay. I've written my intro, so do you feel prepared today?
I do. It's always better. You know, it gets me in the mood.
Excellent. I'm glad to hear that. Are you in the mood for this? Liverpool 3, Manchester City 1. A rare example in the Premier League of a game that actually lived up to its hype. Would you say that was the best game so far this season?
Ooh, that's a question. There's probably been one or two better. I don't know, but off the top of my head. But I really enjoyed this. It was a terrific game. And I thought a pretty well-deserved win for Liverpool.
Yeah, it was. I mean, interesting, I would say, bearing in mind how their first goal came about. We're going to have to talk about this handball and Jonathan Wilson's paradox that seems to have taken over
the Wilson scenario.
Twitter. We need Doc Brown to give us some kind of analysis, I would say. So the way that Liverpool opened the scoring was through a fantastic goal from Fabinho, but that came 22 seconds after Trent Alexander-Arnold handled the ball in the area and Manchester City appealed for a penalty. Michael Oliver waved it away. The worldy goal comes. It was completely breathless stuff. Lars, your opinion, please.
On the handball decision?
Yeah.
Well, I just think I would take it back to what Mike Riley said before the season started, because you might remember in the summer the handball law changed completely, and in the first tournament with the new rules, the Women's World Cup, we saw immediately that the new law is really daft. We had some truly bizarre handballs being awarded in that tournament because the new law puts a new emphasis on the silhouette of the body and whether it makes it bigger and this sort of thing. And Mike Riley said then, and I quote, "We're not looking for the ball to be striking arms, and we do accept when we're looking for what is an unnatural position for the arm that arms move. We don't expect players to defend with their arms behind their back, nor do we expect forwards to try and drill the ball to the hand to win the free kick." And I think that kind of sums up both that penalty shout and the later one in the game where the ball was struck against, I think it was Mane from a very short distance. You know, Mike Riley, the head of the referee, does not want Trent Alexander-Arnold to have to run around like a penguin with his arms on his back or like a bollard or something and some waddle about in the box. And the arm was out from the body a little bit, yeah. But I guess in the Premier League, they are going to be a little bit more lenient. I think what makes it very frustrating for fans is that it is basically now impossible to know what is a handball in the Premier League. The new law is very vaguely worded to begin with, and Mike Riley has basically said that we're essentially going to ignore the new law. So what exactly constitutes a handball in the Premier League is now basically impossible to say.
Yeah.
And that makes it really frustrating. And it means if you are an angry fan on the internet and you want to vent your frustration in some direction, there's all kinds of scope for conspiracy and stuff. So the internet's become a pretty wild place. But I don't know. I don't mind that not being a penalty, to be honest. But I would like the rules to be a little bit clearer.
Marcus, do you mind it being a penalty? Because it did hit Bernardo Silva's arm first. His arm was in a natural position.
Yeah.
To me, Trent Alexander-Arnold's arm was not in a natural position.
I agree. I mean, I guess we can all say they're natural because they're parts of our body and so on, but it was outside his body and it was enough distance from where the ball came from to hitting the arm that you conceivably thought he could have had a chance to pull it away and so on. So I thought it was a penalty. And I guess one of the another kind of dimension of the handball rule is the kind of it counts if it leads directly to a goal. So it counts in certain situations and not in others. That is utterly ridiculous in a way. You can't have one rule for what happens and then leads to a goal or not. But apart from that, I thought that was a penalty. I didn't think the second when Raheem Sterling was so close to him and he was standing with his arms next to his body, I didn't think that was a penalty, but I thought the first one was.
Mm. It's probably a good thing in terms of football that it was ruled out, because we wouldn't have been able to celebrate that fantastic Fabinho goal. I mean, it was a pretty rubbish clearance from, I think it was Gundogan, wasn't it? But he took it so well, didn't he, Barry?
Yeah, he doesn't score many. I had to do a feature on him for The Observer on yesterday, and I was just going through his past career, and when he was in France, he scored like about 27 goals over three seasons, and I was going, like, crikey, you know, because I think he's only got one in his time at Liverpool, but it turns out most of those were penalties. You know, he started life as a right back, he's a very good penalty taker, that's so, you know, he's handy as a pocket knife for Liverpool. But it was a wonderful strike. Gary Neville criticised Claudio Bravo, said he should have saved it, which I think is nonsense. I don't think there was a hope in hell of him saving it. And David Priest, a former goalkeeper, he said on Twitter that Bravo did nothing wrong, and there was a couple of outfield players who should perhaps have closed him down. But it really did stay hit. You know, it was a wonderful, wonderful strike.
This is the problem sometimes, isn't it? That the narrative is already written before the game, and a lot obviously was made about Manchester City's makeshift defence, Bravo in goal in place of an injured Edison. But Liverpool were superior everywhere, taking that out of account.
Yeah, they had this tactic of switching the play from one wing to the other, which kind of bamboozled Manchester City a bit and had quite a few of their players caught out of position and not where they needed to be. Having said that, Manchester City did create chances. There was a few you would have expected them to score, Sergio Aguero in particular. But Liverpool pretty much bossed them in most departments. Their two full backs are just wonderful. Jordan Henderson was excellent. Fabinho was excellent. And I think Dejan Lovren deserves a hell of a lot of credit for his performance as well. I thought he was their best defender, and for a player who has been much maligned and who I thought he was going to be sold during the summer. It looked like he was nailed on to go to AC Milan, and that didn't happen. He's third or fourth choice there, and he was excellent coming in such a high-pressure game.
Yeah, he made a couple of really crucial blocks. Would you say there are a better pair of fullbacks in the world at the moment, Lars?
No, and I think it's really interesting the way Liverpool use them. Because when you look at the Liverpool team, I mean, the biggest threat really are the sort of inside forwards, Mane and Salah. That's like the biggest threat to your goal. So, and Mourinho was talking about this in the Sky Sports studio, like any sane manager who comes up against Liverpool will make sure there's not too much space between your fullbacks and your centre-halves, because that's the space where Mane and Salah likes to attack, and that's where they're very deadly. But the offshot of that, if you tighten up your back four a little bit, it leaves quite a lot of space for the fullbacks to run into, which is, I think, part of the reason why their fullbacks have become such a really dangerous weapon. And in the sort of early Klopp period, it was remarked by a lot of people, probably including myself, that he's sending the fullback so far up the field, it's becoming really difficult for the centre-halves. Like, they end up being stranded. But they get away with it now, partially because, like, Van Dijk is there, his recovery speed is very good, but also because the midfield are really disciplined in covering the spaces behind the fullbacks when they go forward. It's a really good system that they've devised. And I think just a word of... I actually didn't think City were that bad. I mean, if you just go through the game and look at the chances they produced, if they had been as efficient as Liverpool, goal, it could have been a different game. And like, Guardiola was obviously in a bit of a tetchy mood after the game, but I thought he made a perfectly reasonable point. Maybe not when he said it was all the best performance and this is why we're champion, but he did say, like, it is true that Liverpool score with their first two shots in the game, and that's not normal, and that is something that will affect the flow of it in a pretty big way. And that's part of why I liked the game so much, was that it was a top of the table clash where both teams looked good. You could see, but these are the two best teams in the league and probably two of the best teams in Europe. And I thought we saw both of that, from even if the City were a bit iffy defensively in a couple of moments.
But that's just being clinical, isn't it? I mean, I think we're all agreed that Liverpool deserved to win that game yesterday. It was really interesting to hear what Pep Guardiola said afterwards. It was quite funny, actually, when he went up to the referee, Michael Oliver, shook his hand and said, "Thank you so much." With perhaps a tiny tinge of sarcasm, although he did deny that in his post-match interview. Just one shot on target for City in the second half, though. So how were they limited to just that?
Well, I actually came away from the game a little bit like Lars, thinking we're actually Liverpool better. But this is possibly partly because I came into the game late and saw the last 60 minutes and then watched the first 30 minutes afterwards when Liverpool were better. But The thing I saw live, I thought City were better. And if Aguero had scored that chance with 10 minutes to go, I think they could have got an equaliser. I thought Sterling was absolutely outstanding every time he got the ball. I mean, Trent Alexander-Arnold had to push him, and in the end they ended up with two right backs against him. And it wasn't quite their day, but I didn't come away feeling that Liverpool were that superior. They were more clinical, like you say, but were they a much better side on the day? I'm not sure.
It was interesting to have Joe Gomez and Trent Alexander-Arnold trying to keep Sterling at bay.
Yeah, you say only one shot on target in the second half, but Man City did create more shots in general throughout the game. They had more shots than Liverpool, and XG suggests they had more dangerous shots as well. Mixed opinions on XG, I know. I'm just going to throw that in there. And I think, you know,
what's the point in having chances if you don't score them, though?
No, but that's the whole point. Like, efficiency is a factor here, and I think the City did a lot of things right. And what about that first goal? Great strike by Fabinho, and that should be the story. But like you mentioned, the Gundogan's behavior in that goal is weird. Like, it's a bad clearance, but also once he's put the ball out in an area that's still clearly dangerous, he just kind of looks away and starts trotting over to the other side of the pitch. Very strange behavior from a senior pro. And this is where you wonder if that area that Fabinho shoots from, if Fernandinho plays in his regular defensive midfield position, is there no one there? You tend to feel like that would be Fernandinho territory if he would have been playing in his usual position. You can understand why Guardiola feels now that he doesn't trust Stones and Otamendi at the back, as that seems to be a complete dumpster fire whenever they play together, and you have to have... Yeah, Fernandinho not being there is a big loss. I don't know. But it was a very fascinating game.
They have a lot of losses, though. I mean, Rodri had to come back a couple of weeks early from injury to start. They're without Laporte, Zinchenko, Otamendi. Mendy was left out of the squad entirely. Pep said afterwards that's because he's not quite ready to come back yet. Is it as basic and simple as these defensive injuries have potentially cost Manchester City the title?
I think it's cost them a lot of points. I mean, Liverpool are very good. I think these missing players for City certainly not helping. Their defence seems very lacking in confidence. You always think there's a good chance they'll concede a goal. But, you know, I would be loath to take any credit away from Liverpool, who are a very good side. But, it isn't helping them, of course. And the fact that Pep Guardiola doesn't seem to trust the central defenders he has that are fit also doesn't help.
So Liverpool now 9 points clear of Manchester City, who dropped down to fourth. Leicester 2, Arsenal 0, with Jamie Vardy and Madison on the score sheet. Leicester City go into the international break 9 points clear of fifth. Fewest goals conceded, second highest number of goals scored, with Jamie Vardy the Premier League's top scorer now. Are Brendan Rodgers' side genuine title contenders?
I don't think so. I think they're genuine top four contenders. I fully expected them to beat Arsenal. They did reasonably easily. Arsenal did all right in the first half. But Leicester are a hugely impressive side, but I can't see them winning it. I suppose if, you know, they are ahead of City, but I still would still expect City to give Liverpool more of a run for their money than Leicester, and maybe that makes no sense because Leicester are a hugely impressive side, but I can't see them winning the title.
We have to talk about...
I would love to be wrong.
Yeah, I'd love you to be. I was like it. I find it fascinating when it's an unexpected challenger comes into the mix, and we'll obviously talk about Chelsea shortly as well. From an Arsenal point of view, though, Unai Emery for the first time using a back three in the league. Did he get the tactics wrong again, Marcus?
Yes, I'd say so, but there's no guarantee they would have gone any better with a back four. Frankly, it's funny how we this season we Arsenal go to Leicester and we just expect a Leicester win. That's how far they've fallen, and it was deserved. And they were much better. Leicester is such a nicely balanced side with Ndidi possibly not getting enough credit for what he does in that midfield and so on. But Arsenal were never really in it, and it's that there's no confidence, there's no plan, the substitutions came late. Why not change something when it's not working earlier? So it was deserved, and Arsenal in real trouble.
Is it a manager devoid of confidence as well as the players, do you think?
I think he is appearing a bit scared, if that's not too harsh, a bit worried about how does he play Özil, how does that play out with the fans, and Xhaka, is he a scapegoat now because it's not picking him for such a long period of time? I think he's making certain team selections because trying to save himself.
It is weird that he's gone from saying that the club have this sort of strategy vis-a-vis Özil, and it's not just his decision, it's a club strategy, and now suddenly he's back in again. Financially, I think it kind of does make sense to try to encourage him to go away because he's probably not worth the contract they've handed it to him, and that's probably hamstringing the club a little bit.
But he has to play in order for someone to come in and get him. So I do see the catch 22 therein.
Maybe, but maybe also if he really doesn't want to leave, one way of encouraging him to leave would be to freeze him out like he was doing earlier in the season. But then doing a 180 on that and putting him back into the team, it's kind of hard to know what this club strategy is. It's a funny thing looking at this game. Leicester just have a better team than Arsenal now. Like, you'd take, man for man, all being equal, you'd take the Leicester defence over the Arsenal defence any day of the week. Mm-hmm. You'd take the Leicester midfield over the Arsenal midfield. And up front, there's maybe a discussion to be had, but Vardy is on this incredible run of form this season that I think you probably just about have him over Aubameyang as well, the way he's playing right now. They're just a better team. And I don't know if they can keep it up, but they're, again, our old friend expected goals suggest that they are overperforming a little bit. Actually, no team in the top five European leagues, are overperforming their expected goals by more than Leicester City at the moment. So perhaps there will be a little sort of regression there. But the question isn't for me whether they can keep it up and chance for the title. The question is, I mean, they have a 9-point lead on Arsenal, they have a 10-point lead on Man United, and they have a 12-point lead on Tottenham. Like, can any of those three overtake Leicester with that gap between now and the end of the season? I'm not sure they can, and that would be enough for a Champions League spot, and that would be an amazing season for them.
And do you think Arsenal are now thinking, why on earth did we not go for Brendan Rodgers?
Probably. I think a lot of clubs are probably thinking the same.
Stuart James, formerly this parish now at The Athletic, had a good article on, I think it was Thursday or Friday, where he spent the day with Brendan Rodgers, you know, at a training at Leicester, and then did an interview. And Rodgers, I'll admit, I always thought he was a bit of a gobshite, you know, just the whole... A bit Brentian, if you know what I mean.
It was that documentary where he had the picture on his of himself on the wall, wasn't it? Yeah, it didn't do him any favours, perhaps.
It didn't do him any favours. But then I've read books by Mike Calvin in which Rodgers features, and by all accounts, he's a very decent, generous guy, particularly with managers, say, who are out of work. He'll offer, you know, come and work with me for a few days and just get you out of the house, you know, and... very generous with his time, and he was saying to Stuart James that there's this perception of him which isn't necessarily fair, but there's very little he can do about it. And he would say, most people who have this perception of me as, you know, being a bit Brentian and a bit up myself, not his words, most people who have that perception would be people who don't know me. And that's fair enough. I don't know him. And he, but, you know, Calvin speaks very highly of him. And if he's good enough for Calvin, he's good enough for me. So, yeah, but I would say Arsenal are regretting not getting him in.
He's always been very nice whenever I've met him. Very, very polite, very friendly, very professional. But, you know, it shouldn't make any difference about your perceptions of him behind the scenes. Look what he's doing on the football pitch.
Yeah, and I think what's underappreciated about Brendan Rodgers is that, I mean, it's incredibly hard to make it as a top-level manager, even if you start as an established sort of international superstar player and you have everything going for you. You have friends in the game, you can take all the courses, everything. Even then, it's really, really hard to make it. And Brendan Rodgers, I mean, at one point as a young man, I believe he was working in a warehouse near Reading and sort of coaching youth players on the side. I mean, if you're there, I mean, even if you're the most smart tactical football mind in history, getting from there to being in charge of a professional football club, that's unlikely to ever happen. Getting from there to being in charge of a Premier League club, completely forget about it. Like, that's a greasy pole that's almost impossible. It is impossible to climb. And Brendan Rodgers has made his way up. And I think whatever you think of him, and his results right now are good, at one point his result might dip and he might not be flavour of the month anymore. I think people should have more respect for the fact that he's gone from where he was to where he is now. It's an incredible achievement in itself, really.
He also had a kind of like a quite public midlife crisis, which I don't think didn't help his cause, but no, he's doing a fantastic job, so good luck.
In terms of Unai Emery, I saw a couple of articles this weekend suggesting that the Arsenal hierarchy are standing by him.
They have apparently briefed the media saying they would be standing by him. And
is that a mistake?
Well, Arsblog, who knows far more about these things than I do, seems to think it is a very serious error. I saw him tweet to that effect this morning. So if he's not happy, signs aren't good.
We've got to talk about the Leicester penalty appeal, unfortunately. Soyuncu pulled back by Guendouzi, no penalty given. Looked pretty obvious to me. I hate talking about VAR every week. Unfortunately, we have to. And the introduction of it was surely for incidents like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a clear penalty and I can't quite understand why it wasn't given.
Done. Leicester face Liverpool on Boxing Day. I'm sure Brendan Rodgers would absolutely love to win that one as well. Now, talking of potential title contenders, Chelsea 2, Crystal Palace 0. Tammy Abraham and Christian Pulisic on the score sheet again. Did we write Frank Lampard's Chelsea off too early? Their sixth Premier League win in a row. Last time they did that, they won the title. Could they be in with the shouts?
Well, I'm not including Leicester in the conversation, so I'm probably not going to include Chelsea either. Again, I'd love a four-way title race. It'd be fantastic. They are hugely impressive under Lampard. I'm surprised by how good they are, to
There's
be honest.
No pressure on them or Leicester, which surely
yeah, they're both
it works
kind of getting free
favour.
Swings. And they're both sides seem to be really enjoying themselves. And if I was a fan of either team, I'd be enjoying watching them play, which I think people sometimes forget that's what going to football is all about.
Very true. I tell you what I did enjoy. I enjoyed so much that first goal. Willian with his back to goal and that tiny flick for Abraham. That was my goal of the weekend.
Yeah, I can see why. He's such a lovely player, Willian.
Bearing in mind, he's 31, captained the side as well at the weekend. But that's the youngest Chelsea side that's ever played in the Premier League, which was impressive in itself. And that's exactly what you see with Leicester as well. Youngsters coming out, having, you know, no point to prove at all and playing some fantastic stuff.
Yeah, and I think if there's a big lesson from Chelsea's season so far, it is that if you have young players who have looked good out on loan, then there's a thing to be said for giving them a run in the team at the Premier League. I mean, it's not the fact that young Chelsea players are doing well does not automatically mean you could throw in as many youngsters as possible and all will be well. Note to a compatriot of mine at Old Trafford. But the thing about Chelsea is that if you look at the young players there, they've been out on loan. Like Mason Mount has played a full season in the Championship. Tomori's been out on loan. Like Abraham has been out on loan several times, and they've all shown at a lower level that they can do it. And if you've played a full season in the Championship and looked good, and you're sort of 20, 21 thereabouts, the logical next step is to have a run in the team in the Premier League, surely.
Well, you say that, but historically, that's not what Chelsea have done. They've farmed out really, all their good players.
Or almost no one does this, and it takes a bit of bravery, and it takes you need to accept on club level that it might not work, and it might cost you some points. I think Wenger has a great line about this: is that you basically pay for the education of young players with points, which I think is a way of looking at it. But I think there are really talented players around in these Premier League clubs. I don't think it's just at Chelsea, and hopefully more of them will get runs in the team.
Yeah, we are talking Chelsea, though. So would you, with that, bearing that in mind, think that the transfer ban that was imposed on them this season could actually have been the best thing to happen to them? To say there is a different way of doing it, and actually potentially be the best thing that could happen to English football?
Yes, I would say so. I am not sure they would have gone for Lampard without the transfer ban being in place. It was a perfect opportunity. The pressure was off. They might have gone for another foreign coach, had him for a year and been stuck in the same cycle. It's forced Lampard in a way to play these players, but I think he's done it extremely well. You don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but the way he's managed Pulisic, for example, seems to have been the perfect way to get the best out of him, because he's been absolutely superb since he came back into the side. And there's so much going for them. I actually think Leicester is a better shout for the title, because no European games whatsoever. They're a bit more experienced. But Chelsea look pretty certain for a top four, which means that United, Arsenal and Spurs are really going to struggle this season. They might even have to start planning for next season without Champions League football in January, February.
And I thought an interesting point about this game is that throughout this run of winning games, Chelsea have still been guilty sometimes of allowing the opponent slightly more chances than you ideally want to see. They've gotten away with it, but that's fine. But I thought in this game, they didn't at all. I mean, Crystal Palace didn't have a sniff, and Crystal Palace have been quite okay this season.
They played very well, actually.
Yeah, but they had like three shots throughout the game. Like, they had very few chances, and I wonder how much of that was actually because N'Golo Kante was back. We forget that they've basically been without him for most of the season, and he's one of the best sort of most effective ball winners in the world, really. So having him back in the mix there could add a whole lot to that team as well.
Yeah, youngest manager against the oldest manager, and Roy Hodgson did say afterwards that he was actually really proud of his players because he didn't really see what else they could have done, and on the performance that I saw, I would tend to agree. And I do hope that Barry's prediction of a four-way title race does come true, because that would be amazing. That's it for part one. Coming up in part two, we'll round up the rest of the Premier League action. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. We have some live shows. Don't forget, November the 27th, Indigo at the O2 in London. It's the last chance to see Football Weekly live in the capital for a little while. Max Barry, Jonathan Wilson and Ellis James. December the 20th, back at the Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. Max Lars, Jonathan Wilson and one other. And then in January 2020, the 27th and 28th at Liberty Hall in Dublin. The 27th is sold out, but 28th over halfway now, so get your tickets. That's going to be Max and Barry plus two others. Right, Tottenham 1, Sheffield United 1. Chris Wilder leading the VAR protests on Saturday, pretty upset, as he's entitled to be as well when you look back at it. He spoke very calmly on the matter, but I mean, has it really come down to the size of John Lundstrom's big toe or someone's armpit?
Well, it has, and it's ridiculous, but this is where we are, and I'm not sure how we're ever going to get away from it. I suppose by the exact letter of the law, there was an offside. It wasn't in the phase of play that led to the goal, but you know, I'm shrugging my shoulders here. I'm running out of things to say about this, but I felt very sorry for McGoldrick because I think it was his first goal.
It would have been his first Premier League goal.
Yes, yeah. And he's been getting a bit of stick for missing chances. He really needed that. But that's it. I really felt sorry for him in particular. I felt a bit sorry for Sheffield United as well because they thoroughly deserved to win that game, and I'm not sure how they didn't win it because they had more than enough chances to beat Spurs. So, and to be fair, I don't think Wilder was moaning too much. I mean, he was asked on Goals on Sunday, did you have a word with the ref afterwards? And he said no, because I was going out and I was in a rush to get changed.
In fairness, he'd have probably been in there for a long time.
I didn't agree with the decision, but this is where we are. And in fairness, Sheffield United should have won anyway.
Yeah, well, regardless of what the decision eventually was, it took 3 minutes and 47 seconds to make it.
And by contrast, for the Mo Salah goal in the next day against Manchester City, it took no seconds to make, and it was an almost identical situation.
But for the Liverpool offside, I mean, they did release an image to Premier League, which shown that just with the first line, it was pretty clear that he was onside, so there wasn't any point to doing a big check on it. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty clear. I'd much rather talk about how good Sheffield United were, to be honest. I think it's very funny, the discourse in this country, because people can get really paranoid about, oh no, the English lads, they don't get enough credit. Very often the English managers get too much credit, and there are a few of them who just keep walking into job after job after job, even if they've proven themselves to be quite mediocre managers. Chris Wilder, on the other hand, has been amazing over the last couple of years. Like, his record is bonkers, and looking at the way they play, I think he isn't getting enough credit, because whenever we talk about Sheffield United, people talk about, oh yeah, they work really hard and, you know, they're all really focused. But I just think tactically they're set up so cleverly. Wherever Spurs were trying to play in this game, and Spurs were very bad, but wherever they were trying to go with it, there seemed to be more Sheffield United players than Spurs players. Now, wherever they went on the pitch, they were all the Sheffield United players. Now, some of that is hard work and getting around the pitch for sure, but a huge part of it is also organisation. Like, the way he sets up the team is just sensational. Effective, and he deserves more credit for the tactical side of it, I think.
Would you agree, Marcus?
Absolutely, 100%. I think what they've got going for them is that they've come through the divisions together in a way, or up from the Championship, and so he's molded most of these players into his way of thinking. So that's the benefit, rather than bringing in 9 or 10 like Fulham did or Villa did over a season just to change everything. But it's absolutely superb, and it's so nice to see. And I think they're one of the hardest teams to play in the Premier League right now. So I don't think it's necessarily Spurs taking a step back again. I think they were just up against a very good side.
Lars said it last week, that people just do not know how to play against them, and people haven't worked them out yet. And, you know, it's November. People are going to have to start to work them out, aren't they, Barry?
Yes, Spurs certainly had no answers for them. They forced Tottenham into errors, and it was an error by, is it Enda Stevens, who just a loose pass allowed Son to pass or to pounce and get Tottenham's equaliser. Sheffield United, they're just hugely impressive.
And there's a logical fallacy there that a lot of us committed before the start of the season, myself very much included, is that because we've not seen really any of these players play in the Premier League before, we kind of assumed they wouldn't be able to do it. Like, this is the idea, because they're not established Premier League players. They must not be very good because they haven't played at this level. So the automatic assumption is they must not be able to do it. I definitely tipped them to go down. I was completely wrong. If there was any actual pie here, I would eat it. But consider this an apology to Sheffield United fans. Tremendous team so far. Very impressive.
Wolves 2, Aston Villa 1. Ruben Neves and Raul Jimenez on the goal sheet for Wolves. Trezeguet with a late consolation in injury time. A stat from Duncan Alexander here. Ruben Neves in the Premier League, goals 6. Touches in opposition penalty area 4. It was a lovely hit, but Villa had all 10 outfielders defending in a row at that free kick, and you could see Neves was getting ready to hit it from a mile away.
Yes, absolutely. And in hindsight, it's easy to pick up on and so on, but you don't expect it. You don't see it that often, the square pass. And I think it's hard to say just how difficult it is to hit a rolling ball like that with the inside of his foot, and how he got the power with the instep is incredible. It's beautiful to watch, and the curve on it and so on, and no chance for the Villa keeper to save it. But I would also like to pinpoint the tackle he made for the second goal. I think it was he started that move with a crunching tackle on his own penalty area, the edge of his own penalty area. So he's just a complete player, and he's just getting better and better, it seems.
Another player getting better and better, Adama Traore, who won the free kick that led to that Neves goal. He hit the bar, set up Jimenez for the second goal, apparently attempted 11 dribbles, completed 10 of them. And he's had a real week as well. There was speculation he'd agreed to play internationally for Mali. That's the country of his parents. But on Saturday, he was called up by Spain, the country in which he was born, and has played youth internationals for as well. Now he's pulled out of the Spain squad with an injury, so he's still not declared his allegiance either way. Fun fact for you, though, Mali already have two other players called Adama Traore. And last year, one of them scored, then was replaced by the other, who also scored. A little bit confusing. Villa lost two players to injury in the first half. Second choice keeper Jed Steer pulling up early on. Replaced, I'm going to apologise in advance for my pronunciation, Lars. Norwegian Ørjan Nyland.
Ørjan Nyland. I've sat next to him on a bus once.
That's nice. Where were you going?
I was covering the Norwegian under-21s. And this is a sign of just how different the media landscape can be in Norway, because I was covering them and I was staying at the same hotel as the team, and I was sort of in the lobby milling about with my big camera. One of the coaches asked me, "Hey Lars, are you going to film training?" I was like, "Yeah, I'm just going to get some shots." I was like, "Would you just come over in the team bus?" So I got to training on the team bus, and I was sat next to a then quite young and nervous looking Ørjan Nyland, actually, who's a lovely lad.
Did you discuss XG with him?
No, I wish I had. If I'd known he'd end up in the Premier League, I would have made more of an effort to network. I'm really bad at that sort of thing.
Matt Target also was forced off just before half time. So bad times for Villa at the moment. They find themselves 3 points above the relegation zone, and they've still got to play Manchester United, Chelsea and Leicester in their next four league games. So it doesn't get much better. Speaking of Manchester United, they ran out 3-1 winners over Brighton. Lars, did this game teach us anything about either side that we didn't already know?
I don't think so. I feel like the last two United games have confirmed most of the things we felt like we already knew about them. Like at Bournemouth, they really struggled. They conceded first and Bournemouth sat back and they couldn't open them up, and we've seen that before. And then in this game, Brighton were playing higher up the pitch, so United had space to attack into. If you look at the first and the third Man United goal, hitting people on the break with like Martial and Rashford running into space. We know they're good at that, that they're really dangerous, but it was really important for them to get a win because it was getting a little bit dire. So, fair enough.
United had a little bit of luck to get themselves into this one as well. Within 2 minutes, a deflection for Pereira's goal. Then Davy Proper put the ball into his own net. So they were 2-0 up within 20 minutes, Barry. They need that luck sometimes, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, Brighton had a bit of luck as well because Marcus Rashford missed an absolute sitter. still struggling to figure out how he managed to put that effort wide with, two-thirds of the goal gaping. He's right in front of it. But it just shows everyone's capable of comedy howlers, no matter how high the standard they're playing. I'm not sure what to make of Manchester United anymore. You know, they were all hideously bad against Bournemouth, lost, deserved to win this game probably. And they're just kind of, they're a mid-table side, are they?
Isn't that interesting?
You just don't know what you're going to get from them on any given week. And it's a long, long time since I think Manchester United have been like that. You know, if we look past the latter stages of the Mourinho era, I can't remember a time when Man United were quite like that. I was definitely a small boy at the time.
A wee lad. Brighton, though, are pretty inconsistent themselves. They do some amazing things, then they do some bang average things. Their problem in this game, perhaps chance creation, just 6 shots all game.
They didn't seem themselves. I, like all of you, watched mainly highlights from the game, but they seemed a bit off. Maybe they thought they were slightly better than they actually are, and home and away, there's a big difference, and they are probably a bit similar to United now. Good at home can beat anyone, bad away.
Yeah, after the international break, Manchester United have to go to Sheffield United, which, as we were just saying, is going to be much, much trickier than anybody was expecting before the start of the season. Quite enjoyed this game. Newcastle United 2, Bournemouth 1. Nicely worked corner routine for the opener for Harry Wilson. That was in the 14th minute, and after that, just one shot on target for Bournemouth. But they had 66% of possession. Although, when you look at it, as opposed to Bournemouth being bad, there was some real solid defensive work from Newcastle, Marcus.
Newcastle were good, actually, and coming after the win at West Ham, like Steve Bruce said afterwards, back-to-back Premier League wins are pretty rare for quite a lot of teams, and it was hugely satisfying. And having gone behind to that early wonderful goal, the corner routine, they responded really well and had some chances. And as soon as Saint-Maximin and Almiron and Joe Linton will start scoring, they might actually be pretty safe.
They have to start scoring at some point, right? I mean, Joe Linton's got one.
He got scored the winner against Tottenham.
It is just
there was just one comedy of errors in that game where Saint-Maximin should have scored and then Almiron should have scored but fired against Saint-Maximin.
Who
was lying on the ground in front of him, and he just got, oh, for the love of God, will one of you just put the ball in the net?
And they had at least one of those last weekend as well against West Ham. Becoming quite fascinating. I do think they're starting to look more like a Steve Bruce side in the sense that they're quite reliable, they're decent at the back. And if you have those two on the counter, and Joe Ellington is quite quick as well, I think they're going to trouble quite a lot of teams. It's just you need, I guess, a more reliable goal scorer would be good. I think Almiron can score. Just wonder if it's a confidence thing at this point. I mean, I've seen him score a lot of goals in MLS, but, you know, still. And he can do it, but after all this time, there must be a mental block there almost now.
Well, luckily for Newcastle, their defenders are scoring. Yedlin with the equaliser, that was Saint-Maximin with the ball in for him. Then Kieran Clarke bundling it in. He said afterwards it was a deft touch. I think the laughter.
I believe him.
It's very deft.
Bottom of the table clash. Norwich 0, Watford 2. Gerard Deulofeu with the opener on 2 minutes. Andre Gray on 52. Christian Cabasele saw red with 25 minutes left to go. Watford finally have that win. The final of the 91 teams in the top four divisions to get victory this season. So congratulations to them, Marcus.
Yes, absolutely. And I did catch some of this game, and it probably helped by the early goal. It was interesting to see Watford looking much more confident than Norwich. And obviously for a team that hadn't won the season, it says a lot about where Norwich are at the moment. And even after the sending off, I didn't think that Norwich threatened that much. And so they're in real trouble now, I think. And Watford looked much better. And Deulofeu is such a lovely player when he plays at his best, his touches and his running and he's got that movement. He can just glide past players, and he had a really good game.
Yeah, he did. It was a really good goal. Nicked the ball back, went on a run, finished it in the box. But Norwich, I mean, we must start to see some of their players come back soon that have had terrible luck with injuries this season, Daniel Farke, but they're really struggling at the back. And of course, you know, we've been discussing it the last couple of weeks, Timu Pukki is just not scoring.
Well, no. Am I officially barred from mentioning XG now? Have I mentioned it too many times on the pod already?
No. But it's part of your DNA, Lars.
Timu Pukki's numbers did show pretty early in the season that this is probably not sustainable, what was going on back then. I think with Norwich, is more stuff like, again, God bless him, I'm a huge fan of his, both as a player and as a person, but Alex Tetti is not a centre-half. I mean, this was the second time in his career, in his entire career, that he played at centre-half. I'm sure he's trying his best, but that's not a great place for Norwich to be having to use him in that position. I'd be very surprised if that's something that turned out to be a viable option in the Premier League going forward. So they got to get people fit and back.
Andre Gray scored the second goal off the outside of his boot, but it took a deflection from Jamal Lewis. But at least he's back scoring for Watford. Is this going to get them, you know, a little bit back on side with Kike and start to propel them? Or was it just a bottom of the table clash against a side who are really struggling and it's going to be situation normal after the international break?
I think the latter scenario, to be honest. I think if they had lost that game against Norwich, Kike might have been shown the door, to be honest.
Two managers before November.
Yeah, well, that would be quite the achievement. But I wouldn't read too much into this. Norwich are a bit of a mess at the moment. So I kind of expected Watford to win this game. You know, going back, their performance against Tottenham was very good. They didn't win. They should have. But then they didn't play well in the game after that. But they showed signs of life against Spurs. I'd read more into that performance than this one, to be honest, even though they didn't win that game.
Good to read positives into the Burnley performance, though. They were 3-0 winners over West Ham. Both of these teams had been struggling of late, but Sean Dyche's side in particular ending a run of three defeats in a row, so crucial for them. Chris Wood back from injury made a big difference. Him and Ashley Barnes both signing new contracts this week. Definitely grateful to the club for that, because both on the score sheet. Barnes' goal drought is over. He got the first and Wood got the second at the second time of asking after VAR ruled out his first effort. But West Ham now haven't won in six games. Big problems for Manuel Pellegrini. I think it's 2 points from 15 since that win over Manchester United. And that was the point that they sacked Slaven Bilic and replaced him with David Moyes last time. So should Manuel Pellegrini be worried, Marcus?
Yes, absolutely. And partly because there doesn't seem to be any ideas of how to fix this. It's been a long run now. And if you get games like on paper Newcastle at home where you should do better and you could be 5-0 down by half time, then it is time to worry. It seems again there the confidence has gone and the signings have not worked. And like Jacob wrote last week, that the sporting director's position is now under threat, and that's a Pellegrini ally there. So it's looking grim. I suspect they have enough quality to get themselves out of it, but if they don't win in the next two or three games, he might go.
I've seen a lot of West Ham this season. They are one of those incredibly frustrating teams where, as you say, they have enough quality where you think that they're going to do something decent. But for me, the big miss is Lukas Fabianski out injured, and Roberto just isn't up to it.
Well, I've seen him much maligned in two different games. I think it was the Newcastle game and this one. And while he did look quite dodgy in both, he also made some excellent saves in both.
Yeah.
And helped keep... Well, he simultaneously helped keep the score up and down. So he kind of cancels himself out, I suppose.
He's like scales.
He's not entirely useless, but he doesn't seem to inspire confidence. I think it would be very unfair to scapegoat him for their current problems, but he is one of many problems they have.
Final Premier League game of the weekend, Southampton 1, Everton 2. Everton have got their first away win of the season. Is it too late for them to try and win the Everton Cup, Barry?
Who knows?
There are actually... No, but they're actually 3 points off of fifth.
Okay.
That's the kind of...
Really?
That's the kind of bizarro season we're having. That they've been... It feels like they're having a mare this season, but not that many mid-table teams are any good. So that's where we're at. I mean, they could... They're still...
So you're saying they could be in... We could have a five-team title race.
They have... that's not what I'm saying, Baz. I'm saying they have a real chance at getting the Everton Cup.
Richarlison was pretty impressive. I mean, the thing is with Everton this season, when he's on it, they're on it. Mm. And he was really up for the game and made... You know, some impressive runs. He stood up. I was listening to Marco Silva's post-match interview on Match of the Day, and he was, you know, he told Richarlison, you know, not to go down easily, to stand up, you know, more solidly, and that's exactly what he's been doing.
Yeah, and he wasn't saying he was a diver, and he pointed out, you know, he's hasn't got any yellow cards for diving, but yeah, just to be stronger and impose himself more. And yeah, I mean, he's one of those players that, you know, he blows hot and cold, but on his day he's excellent. Again, how much do you read into a win over Southampton, though? Because they are a shambles, and the crowd there at St. Mary's incredibly unhappy with the team. Ralph Hasenhüttl looks like he's given up and is just waiting for the inevitable. And they have big problems.
I think maybe the fact that Everton hadn't won away since March, and also after the 9-0 defeat, there were two City games, and he probably thought, okay, we'll work defensively, we'll do that, but this one we need to win, and they didn't, and maybe that was so hard, because if you can't beat Everton at home in the moment, you are probably in trouble.
Yeah, Danny Ings got the equaliser for them. They looked to be back in it after Tom Davis had put Everton ahead, but Richarlison with the eventual winner in the end. Right, in the Football League, new Stoke Bond. Michael O'Neill's had the instant new manager bounce with a 4-2 win over Barnsley. He was named, of course, as Nathan Jones' replacement on Friday. Interestingly, he's still going to be in charge of Northern Ireland for the upcoming games against the Netherlands and Germany, and also any potential Euro 2020 playoff matches next March. So he's going to be a busy man. The top three all won. West Brom stay at the summit after a 1-0 win over Hull. Second placed Preston ended Huddersfield's 7-game unbeaten run with a 3-1 victory at Deep Dale. Elsewhere, Leeds stay third after beating Blackburn 2-1 with Patrick Bamford ending his goal drought. His penalty was his first goal in 11 games. There was a thriller at Hillsborough as well. Sheffield Wednesday scoring late to hold Gary Monk's former side Swansea to a 2-2 draw. 12 goals now for Fulham's Alexander Mitrovic this season as Fulham move into sixth after a 1-0 win over Birmingham. Middlesbrough now without a win in 9, but Britta Sombolonga scored twice to rescue a point for Jonathan Woodgate's side in a 2-2 draw at QPR. A late Matt Smith header helped Millwall win the South London derby against Charlton. Wigan lost 3-0 to Brentford, leaving them 2 points above the relegation places. And I was unfortunately at the Madejski Stadium to see a formerly apathetic crowd singing Mark Bowen's Barmy Army as Reading beat Luton 3-0. That's now 4 games unbeaten since Bowen took over. Luton, though, now just a point above the bottom three, with the international break coming at a particularly good time. Fit Bar Barry.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty regulation weekend in the Scottish Premiership. Celtic beat Motherwell 2-0. Motherwell player was criticised on social media for not wearing a poppy, and it turned out just he had been wearing one, but the sticker fell off his jersey. Nothing to see here. Rangers beat Livingston 2-0. These games obviously came on the back of the two Old Firm sides' exploits in the Europa League. Celtic have qualified for the knockout stages with 2 games to spare, which is quite commendable. A lot of people were unhappy when Neil Lennon took the job, and I think he deserves credit for... Personally, I think qualifying for the knockout stages of the Europa League should be the very least Celtic should be aiming for, or the very least of their ambitions, but it's something they have struggled to do in the past. He's done it with 2 games to spare. They had a good win at Lazio, which is a good result by any standards. And Rangers are not through yet, but they're in a good position. They're second in their group, level on points with Young Boys. On 7 points each, they beat Porto, which again is a good result. And elsewhere in the Scottish Premiership, Hearts, now no longer managed by Craig Levein, they beat St Mirren by a whopping 5-2 in what was probably the most remarkable result in a kind of not very interesting weekend in the Scottish Premiership.
I think ex-Luton midfielder Ollie Lee got one of those goals. Right, women's football, there was a big game on at the weekend. Don't know whether anybody saw the attendance by any chance. Barry, did you see how many people were at Wembley?
I found it very hard to avoid the attendance. So many people were reporting it with such breathless excitement, and so they should, because to get 77,000 plus into Wembley for any game is good, and for a women's football match is pretty remarkable. I've been getting abuse on social media, minor abuse, after my comments on Thursday, but I stand by them. I think a big attendance like that should be reported, should be applauded, but it seems to be reported and applauded at the expense of reporting what actually happens in the game. A specific example, the FA website, they reported the attendance for this game. They didn't report the result, and I suppose you can't really blame them because England were pretty crap.
I was going to say, we haven't reported the result either, because it was England women 1, Germany 2. Nikita Paris missed a penalty for England. Alexandra Popp had put Germany ahead. Ellen White then equalised, but Clara Ball got the eventual winner in the 87th minute. The exact attendance, 77,768 on a Premier League match day and with quite disgusting weather, I was quite impressed with. I do now understand why there were question marks over the FA were, you know, punting out right up till the end saying, please turn up. And I don't always think that that necessarily is a positive thing to be saying, because you're already suggesting that people might not do, which suggests perhaps a lot of them were corporate tickets. But still, you know, over 77,000 is an incredible achievement. However, Germany were all over England. I only turned up for the second half. I hot-footed it from the Medeski Stadium. And my family were there, my dad, my sister, my niece and nephew. My niece and nephew were absolutely loving it. My nephew in particular, first thing he said to me, Germany are dirty, they've got three yellow cards, was his first comment. But it was a better performance, I would say, but Germany definitely showed their class. Phil Neville, interestingly, you talk about women's football journalists not always pushing Phil Neville and criticising the team. And I actually will go completely against that, because I think there have been a lot of questions asked about Phil Neville. This is the first time, though, when he's been asked those questions that he has finally admitted that there is a problem. He was asked if the team have gone backwards since the World Cup. His comments, I think so. There's no hiding away from the fact. 1 in 7 is totally unacceptable. I've got to take responsibilities for those results. The buck has got to start and finish with me. The team reflects the manager and the team aren't good enough right now, which means I'm not good enough. And I don't know if any of you watched it. I know everybody was working this weekend. There was so much football on. But same old weaknesses again, particularly in defence.
No. They can't defend crosses.
And they're managed by a defender.
Yeah. I'd find it remarkable. They are staggeringly inept at trying to defend crosses, corners, set pieces in general. They can't take penalties, which again is quite kind of remarkable. But the defending, it's basic. Like that, this is the very minimum you would expect them to be able to do. And yeah, the fact that they're managed by a defender and a guy who was quite a good defender in his day, I find it baffling. And, you know, he continues to talk about what we're going to do in the future. We have a plan. This is what we're going to do in the future. And it kind of reminds me that saying, you know, life is what happens when you're making other plans, is, you know, getting beaten every game you play is what happens when you're planning for the future. At some point they're going to have to start winning games, but I think he's safe in his job because he gets the punters in, you know, and for some reason it's not as if he's Captain Charisma. But
is it him getting the punters in, or is it the growth of women's football, though? Because surely you can't credit Phil Neville with getting the punters in purely on his own.
Well, no, it's slick. I think it's a combination of slick marketing, the fact that people like the players, that it's quite a likeable team.
Do you think he should be given more time and judged on the Olympics, or is this going to start to be a worry now?
I think the best thing would probably to get rid of him and start again and do it now. That might be a bit harsh. I don't really quite believe him when he says it's all on me now, because there's such a change from the last two games when he couldn't take the criticism at all. He was almost at war with the journalists out in Portugal, I think.
He constantly changes his mind. I think he says what people want to hear rather than what he actually thinks.
I think he's learning. I think he's definitely learning.
But I don't think he was honest when it starts with me, it finishes with me and so on. I think that came purely from the criticism he received the last. And then it's all about how do I look and so on. I don't think he's good enough. It's a good team. I mean, we must remember that Germany are a very, very good side. They're young. They player Clara Bull, who scored the winning goal, is 18. I think she's got 7 in 10 games now. They've beaten Ukraine 8-0 twice and Greece 5-0. So they're a very, very good side. And England were played off the park for the first 20-25 minutes. I don't think in isolation it was England's worst performance post-World Cup, because they came into the game, they could have got a draw and so on. But if you 1-7 with those players, it's not good enough, and there should be enough time for someone to take them into the Olympics and a home Euros, which is going to be huge here. And I don't think he's that good. We talked about Emery not having a plan. I don't see a plan with Phil Neville. We talk about Rodgers having a plan and others and so on. And that's the difference for me.
It's interesting, actually, because there have been a few articles discussing whether or not, because they play the Czech Republic on Tuesday in a friendly, largely expected to win that. If they don't, then there are going to be some really serious questions. But I read an article over the weekend saying he refuses to change his style. And there's kind of a question of what is his style, for one. But also not being flexible when you're not winning. I don't understand why you would come out and say that.
And it's almost as if he's proud of his intransigence. And I don't understand that either. It's like, I know what I'm doing, and the rest of you are all wrong. And the evidence of our own eyes suggests that, well, Phil, maybe you don't know what you're doing. I mean, I'll be honest, I don't really care whether he keeps his job or not. I'm not calling for him to be sacked, but he seems so secure in the position, you know, taking it for granted that he is going to be there for the foreseeable future. And
I'm not so sure about that. He looked very stressed on the touchline on Saturday. I think he's feeling the pressure.
If he has coaching ambitions, like beyond being in charge of the England women's team, if he wants to get back in the men's game, if he were to get fired for that, it seriously damages his reputation as a coach. And his reputation as a coach is already not great.
Do you think it would damage it that much?
I think so, yeah.
It's a pretty big appointment for him to have been given that anyway, and no disgrace what he's done. He took England to the semi-finals of the World Cup.
I'd say that was the very minimum expectation. He did worse than in the previous World Cup and spent a hell of a lot more money.
Right, that's it for part two. Part three will start in Spain with Sid. Welcome back to Guardian Football Weekly. We'll start in Spain with Sid Lowe. Sid, big wins for the big three, who now occupy the top three. In order, Barcelona beat Celta Vigo 4-1 with a Messi hat-trick. Real won 4-0 at Eibar, and Atletico came from behind to beat Espanyol 3-1. All important wins given their form this season, but who enjoyed their weekend most, would you say?
I think probably Real Madrid did, and I think that's because this was convincing. This was the best they've played this season. They certainly in the first half, at least, there was a real connection between Karim Benzema and Eden Hazard, who definitely had his best game and was absolutely fantastic for the first half of the match. And you know, as you say, it's important for all of them, and it's partly important because none of them have properly convinced. So this was that performance which finally gave you the sense that Madrid have found a structure now. They found a team that makes sense. I think the inclusion of Valverde makes a difference. I think the movement of the ball was much, much better. And all the way through, let's say that all the way through this season so far, there's been that sense that even when they've had kind of 30 good minutes or 40 good minutes, it's never completely convinced. I think this was the first time that they really did. There's a nice little bit of footage where José Ángel Cote, the fullback at Eibar, is standing there in the pouring down rain. And he's muttering to himself, and of course they get the cameras on this and they do the lip reading, and he's muttering to himself, "This is a fucking whirlwind." And he's not talking about the weather, he's talking about Real Madrid.
Wow. It was the Seville derby last night as well, Sevilla coming out on top and finding themselves fourth. A big night for both Lopetegui and Luke de Jong.
Yeah, I mean, for Luke de Jong, who's this striker, I mean, the phrase that's been used here a lot has been the striker that doesn't score goals. When he scored his first goal for Sevilla, it was against Levante, pretty much in the last minute, I think 88th minute or something, and got them a win, so it was a huge goal. But it was, I think, his 19th shot on goal, and he finally got his first. He then actually, funnily enough, having broken through that kind of, if you like, emotional or psychological barrier, that's when there started to be some rotations, and he wasn't necessarily a first choice in the side. But he was in this weekend, he played really, really well, and scored a fantastic second for Sevilla in the derby. And the derby is, You know, it's difficult to do justice to just how big this is in Spain. You know, even people outside of Seville will tell you this is the best derby in Spain. It's the biggest match of all. And for Lopetegui, it's really important because, of course, he comes to Sevilla off the back of having been Real Madrid manager, and Sevilla fans don't like Real Madrid, off the back of being Spain manager, and Sevilla fans do like the Spanish national team, and there's a certain sense of resentment there. And when he signed in the summer, I think there was, I wouldn't say a rejection, but certainly a kind of a reservation about his signing. And so he really needed this. And of course, the big games that he could have had to have won people over, although their results have generally been pretty good, and I actually think the performances have been quite good as well. They lost to Real Madrid. They drew last weekend with Atletico Madrid. So there was a certain degree of pressure on them. And so winning the derby, even if they, you know, they really struggled in the last 15, 20 minutes when Betis put a lot of pressure on them, is really, really big for him. And you can see it. There's a great bit of footage of him celebrating at the end of the game, and he's kind of screaming, he's got his mouth wide and he punches the air in this kind of incredibly violent way. Now, obviously, celebrating a win like that is not particularly unusual. You see this kind of thing all the time. But actually, from Lopetegui, it is. You know, it's not a normal Lopetegui-style reaction. So I think that's genuinely significant.
Yeah, shows how much it means to him, for sure. Athletic Bilbao beat Levante, who'd just taken 6 points off Barcelona and Real Sociedad.
Yeah.
Bilbao have conceded the joint fewest goals this season, though. They seem to be in a much more stable place these days.
Yeah, and they needed it. They've needed this slight response because they'd had a brilliant start to the season, of course, and went top. They won the Basque Derby early in the season, which is another one of the great derbies in Spain, and then went on a run. I may be wrong in this, but off the top of my head, I think it's 5 games without winning. So they did sort of need to find a way through this, and this response was really good. They won last week with a Munain, well, sort of a Munain hat-trick. I think two of them were his, and one was given as an own goal. And they have come through that little kind of sticky patch. No one truly expected them to stay near the top end of the table, but if they can put themselves in a position where, you know, going into the last couple of months of the season, they've got a chance of a European spot, then they'll be absolutely delighted. The way the table is now, though, and as you said, obviously, you know, Madrid, Barcelona, Atletico are the top three, so that feels a bit normal, but how tight it is, I think, certainly going into this weekend's games, it was 13 teams within 5 points. I think that has stretched out a little bit, but certainly everything from top all the way down to something like ninth or 10th is all really, really close, all within 3 or 4 points.
Brilliant. I love it when it's that tight. Awesome. Cheers, Sid.
Pleasure.
So from Spain to Germany, and the big game was Der Klassiker as a managerless Bayern Munich beat Borussia Dortmund 4-0. Hans-Dieter Flick is the interim head coach. Played 2-1-2, scored 6, conceded 0. Robert Lewandowski scoring 2, keeping up that remarkable scoring record. He's now scored in the last 16 games he's started for Bayern, 16 already in the Bundesliga in just 11 games. So that's 2 wins in 7 now for Dortmund, though. They'll be feeling the pressure down in 6th place. 2 points behind Bayern, who are 3rd. 6 points behind surprise leaders Borussia Mönchengladbach, who go into the international break with a 3-1 win over Werder Bremen and a 4-point lead at the top of the table. Freiburg, another team confounding expectation. They're in 4th, tied with RB Leipzig and Bayern on 21 points. They beat Eintracht Frankfurt 1-0 in the late game yesterday. Extraordinary scenes in the 94th minute. I know you've all seen this, but for anybody who hasn't, take a look on Twitter. I've put it out there. The ball had rolled into the Freiburg technical area. Frankfurt captain David Abraham went to retrieve it to take the throw, and instead just deliberately flattened Freiburg manager Christian Streich. Cue absolute chaos then. The entire Freiburg bench emptying, surrounding him. He obviously got a straight red, as you'd expect, as did Freiburg's Vincenzo Grifo after VAR spotted him pushing Abraham in the face. I mean, it was quite extraordinary, but Frankfurt did later on post a picture from the dressing room with Grifo and Abraham shaking hands.
I just think, like, you should obviously never knock over the opponent's coach. That's not the right thing
to do.
Very
disrespectful.
Like, if there's any coach you shouldn't do it to, is Christian Streich. Like, he's been at Freiburg since, I think, 2011. Year in, year out, does an amazing job on a small budget, keeps them up. You know, he's a proper hero.
He's a 54-year-old man as well.
He's a proper hero in that town. So if you knock him over, it's going to kick off in a big way. I do wonder if Jamie Vardy had run over Unai Emery, would the Arsenal bench have kicked off in quite the same manner? I'm not quite sure. But yeah, no, Streich, lay off Christian Streich. What a guy he is.
He actually came out after the game and was quite funny about it. He said, football is a contact sport. and then said that was on the wrong side of it, though. It was a heated game. We need to calm down. At 54, you can be run over by a young buffalo. You can't hold yourself against it anymore.
Oh, my God. It was just absolutely shocking. I couldn't believe it. I know everybody was laughing about it, but I was angry about it, actually. Talking about.
I haven't seen this, so I'm looking forward to it.
Oh, right, I'll send you the video. Right, from Germany we go to Italy, where Nicky Bandini brings us news of a familiar scene at the top of Syria.
Well, it does look familiar at the top, but it's not so familiar just beneath that. Yes, Inter and Juventus both won again, continuing the relentless pace they've set to start the season. But I want to say a few words about Cagliari, who thrashed Fiorentina 5-2 on Sunday and are all the way up to joint third. This is a team that finished 15th last season, that scored fewer goals than any other team that stayed up. And they were 5-0 up at one point in this game and could have been even more if they hadn't taken their foot off the pedal at the end. The headline to the story is Reggie Nainggolan. He was signed by Inter just a year ago for €40 million. They basically threw him away this summer. They let him leave for on loan for no fee, all of which looks that extra bit brilliant when you then have Antonio Conte complaining he has no experienced midfielders at Inter to play when he needs them in a Champions League game. So anyway, Nainggolan's gone back to Cagliari. They were the first team he played for in Serie A. He did have offers to go elsewhere this summer, but crucially, his wife is from Sardinia and she was recently diagnosed with breast cancer. So he's been very frank in saying that this move is about priorities outside of his career as well as about the football. But the football is working out very well. At the same time as getting Nainggolan back, Cagliari raised this big lump of money by selling Nicola Barella to Inter. They've reinvested it in players like Marco Rojo and Nahit Hernandez, two young and dynamic midfielders that just completely reinvent the heart of the team, with Nainggolan ahead of them at number 10. They've also added Giovanni Simeone to the attack, and suddenly this side that was just all about lumping crosses into the middle last season for Pavoletti, this big sort of classic number 9, is instead playing it on the floor and trying to play fast counter-attacking football. And honestly, it was just brilliant on Sunday. So much fun to watch. Five different scorers and five very different goals as well, with Nainggolan getting one of them, a very Nainggolan goal, just sort of thwacked into the corner from 25 yards, but also a hat-trick of assists. This is their best start since 1969, when they went on to win the league. They already won away to Napoli and Atalanta, as well as drawing away to Roma, so while the league is probably out of the question, a spot in the top four is starting to look quite plausible. But yes, the top two are probably out of reach. The other big story of the weekend, certainly, Cristiano Ronaldo subbed off for the second game running, didn't bother to hang around for the final whistle against Milan. He went straight to the changing room and then home, according to reports in Italy. But his replacement, Paulo Dybala, came off the bench and got the winner, just as his replacement, Douglas Costa, did against Lokomotiv Moscow in midweek. So even though Juventus are still top of the table, perhaps a little bit of trouble brewing in paradise.
Thanks, Nicky. And in France, PSG won 2-1 at Brest. Mauro Icardi coming off the bench to score his 9th goal in 8 games. PSG now 8 points clear at the top. Marseille second after they won 2-1 in the clash of the Olympics against Lyon. Dimitri Payet getting both goals for the home side. Monaco won their 3rd game in 4, this time a 1-0 win over Dijon, taking them up to 11th. Now, over in the United States, a big congratulations to the Seattle Sounders, who won the MLS Cup for the second time, beating Toronto FC in the final. The Sounders came a distant second to overall favourites LAFC in the Western Conference before beating them in the semis and going on to exact revenge in a rematch of the 2017 final, which Toronto won 2-0. And you saw this, Lars.
I did, and Max is not here to defend himself, but shame on him for dissing the Sounders' colours a few pods ago. It's a lovely sort of rave green and blue shirt. It takes a bit of a time to get used to, but really nice colours, and seeing CenturyLink Field really sort of full of mosaic in those colours before the match. It was quite majestic. It's a lovely downtown stadium in Seattle. And I think the Seattle coach, Brian Schmetzer, deserves a lot of credit because he's a rare case of an assistant manager who gets promoted temporarily as a caretaker, gets the job full time and makes a massive success of it. I mean, that almost never happens. And he's not the flashiest name and he's not the most sort of mythologized tactician in the game over there. But yeah, second MLS Cup now with Seattle has done really well, and certainly I think it'd be hard to make a case for Seattle being the best team overall in MLS this season, but they've some real proper big game temperament in that group of players, so you know, well done to them.
Yep, well done to them indeed. We're just going to take a small diversion to Ukraine as Shakhtar Donetsk went 12 points clear at the top of the Premier League with a 1-0 win over arch rivals Dynamo Kiev. Sadly, away from the pitch though, the Dynamo fans racially abused the Brazilian players in the Shakhtar team, one of whom, Tyson, reacted by showing them his middle finger and booting the ball in their direction. That was the referee's cue to use step two of the UEFA protocol and take the players to the dressing room for 5 minutes. Tyson walked off in tears, but when they came back out, the referee sent him off for his reaction. Shakhtar manager Luis Castro then didn't show up for his post-match presser, but did say in a statement that the abuse was an absolute disgrace. On to better news, though. We're a week late, but Marcus, your team won the Swedish league for the first time in 14
thank
years.
Thank you. That was quite an astonishing Saturday. It was down to the final day of the season. How long have we got, by the way? I'll be brief. Final day of the season, three teams could win it. My team, Djurgården, went 2-0 down promptly within 15 minutes, but fought back to get a 2-2 and get the first league title for 14 years. It's been a real team effort. No stars, really. They were probably predicted to finish sixth or seventh, but they've done extremely well. So they got two coaches, so it's a kind of Julia Evans situation at the team. It never works, but they got them from Sirius in the first division, and they've done extremely well, and they didn't lose a game outside Stockholm, just lost to AIK and Hammarby and won by a point.
Yeah, can I add to the Scandi takeover that my compatriot Erling Braut Haaland played, by his admission, quite a poor game this weekend, yet still scored a hat-trick because he's basically unstoppable these days. And if I'm not mistaken, that makes it 26 goals in 18 games for him this year. It's unbelievable what's happening with this guy.
Our favourite grumpy teenager.
Unbelievable.
Right, anyway, that is the end of this week's Guardian Football Weekly. Thank you so much, Marcus.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lars.
Thank you.
Cheers, Baz.
You're welcome. Thanks.
It's Ellis in on Thursday with Max away for a little bit longer, but he will be back next Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.